Hi, everybody. I'm really sorry that the video didn't work when I actually gave this lecture some weeks ago, but I promised to make some kind of video for you, and hopefully I can just explain a couple of the slides that maybe need a little bit of extra help. So welcome to the course, and this is our learning goals for the course. Hopefully you've been enjoying it so far. I'll just go forward here. Maybe some of this beginning stuff I won't go into too much detail because you probably already have found the textbook and know what you should be doing. I guess the m most important thing here is that these extra lisätettävät or extra tasks are available for you to help you improve your exam grade. Most of the grade for the course, 90% of the grade comes from the exam. So I can get the pointer here, maybe a little bit better. So there are some possibilities to improve your exam grade with the extra assignments, and these have their own deadlines. So be sure you're following the Moodle. Hopefully you are. So, most of this, de all these details are found in the Moodle. And basically, the course, if we get down to it, is about genetics and basically thinking about how do genes work, how is genetic information passed from one generation to the next, and what's the kind of relationship between the molecular basis of the genes and their expression. What kind of factors influence expression? There's lots of genetic questions that come into our mind when we think about why genetics is important. And it's also quite popular method included in ecological and evolutionary research, as well as cell molecular biology, medical research, more human-related research. So I'll keep going through this. This understanding of genetics is important, and one reason why we hope that this course is something that everyone in the biology bachelor degree program studies is because we can use this information in a lot of different kinds of research questions. We can understand a lot about basic science, just how genes work, how do they affect the cell, but also more implied questions like breeding. So crop breeding is very critical for genetics is very critical for crop breeding studies to improve crop yields and resistance to pathogens, for example. We also breed animals for our own pleasure, so we use genetic information in these kinds of studies. So in addition to thinking about individual level descent, like maybe with a more human perspective about transmission of specific diseases, we can also think about relationships among individuals and species in an evolutionary sense, and using genetic information to understand the connections between different organisms. So not only basic sciences, but also applied questions. So this first lecture is about our understanding of DNA as the genetic material, how DNA is organized into genes, to units, and what the products of these genes are, the consequences of these proteins, their synthesis, and their effects on cells and organisms. So the main themes of genetics are something that we want to remember. And in this lecture, I talk a lot about how we got to this point, what had to be done before we could actually come to these conclusions and recognize these facts. So there's a lot about history in your textbooks if you read chapters 1 through 3, which are sort of expected for you to kind of review what you know already about genetics. There's a lot about history there, about what was done to understand genes and the genetic material, why we got to the point where we understood that DNA is genetic material. And this is important for many reasons. Not only is it just interesting to learn about history, but it also shows the link between experimentation and different research methods, and also how researchers come to their conclusions. So it's a lot of important background for understanding the progress that we have already made so far in this field. And it also highlights the importance of using different study organisms, because a lot of the conclusions that were made really benefited from the fact that researchers specifically chose a certain organism to study, which enabled them to make deductions about genetics. And it also highlights this kind of importance of interdisciplinary knowledge. So everything from nanobiology, studying viruses, biochemistry, cell molecular biology, all the way to organismal biology. So these kind of connections between a broader range of fields is actually quite important for making deductions about genetics. And hopefully you'll see that in the examples that are shown in the lecture. And also, of course, we have to make new advances. There's still things to learn about genetics, and all of these are done based on the success of the previous researchers. So, you have learned about Mendel's experiments with the pea plants back in the 1860s, and he didn't know about genes or DNA at that point, but he was able to deduce the concepts of genetic inheritance by describing those factors that he called of the cells that has a role in dictating the phenotype of what the organism looks like. So based on his experiments, he made the deductions that genetic material had to preserve information, that it had to be able to be passed from one generation to the next, that it can replicate, and that it can influence how the cell or the organism features how it works and the features of the organisms, and also that it can be altered and it's variable, which is important for evolutionary change. So one of the first experiments that kind of led to the discovery of DNA as being the genetic material was this experiment from Griffith in 1928. So Griffith was using Staphylococcus pneumoniae bacteria, two different strains, the rough and the smooth strain. So based on their appearance, how they grow on agar plates. So the rough ones do not have a polysaccharide coating, and these are susceptible to the immune defense of the organism, but the smooth cells are protected by the polysaccharide capsule, and so they're protected from the immune defense of the host, and therefore they're virulent, or they're able to replicate within the host, and they cause disease in the host. And what was interesting is that when these two strains of bacteria were mixed in the same host, Griffith recognized that the rough strains could be transformed or changed into the smooth strains, and that some exchange of genetic material had happened. So, in the experiment, what was done, the cells of the Staphylococcus were heat killed. So first Griffith made observations of how the living cells affect the host organism, the mouse. So these S cells that are protected by the polysaccharide ca capsule, they cause pneumonia, kill the mouse, but the R cells are susceptible to the immune defense of the mouse. So the mouse remains healthy. But then when these heat killed cells were injected into the mouse, they would not, the heat killing removes the polysaccharide coat from the cells, and so the basically they were not infected by the S cells because they were heat killed. But then when the living R cells were then mixed with heat killed S cells, even though the heat killed S cells don't infect the host on their own, the living R cells would pick up the DNA of the heat killed S cells. And these actually became transformed into this new phenotype, S phenotype, and the mouse contracted the pneumonia. So it was a, after this experiment, it's kind of one of the first observations that the DNA might be, or something in the cell might be causing these phenotypic changes. And the question remained, though, well, what is it that's still there in the cell after the heat killing? Is it the protein that's left over? Is it RNA that's left over? Or is it the DNA? And so in the next experiment that was done was this, or the critical experiment was the one of Avery, McLeod, and McCarthy, which actually narrowed down the actual genetic material in this case. So based on the previous experiments. And so what they did was further diagrammed in this picture from your textbook is that they knew that after killing the S cells with the heat, that there would be DNA, protein, and RNA left in the extract. And Avery, McLeod, and McCarthy then treated these extracts in different ways with different enzymes that were known to affect the different components here individually. So, in some of the extract, they treated them with an RNase, which destroys RNA. I cultured the S cell extract with the R cells to see what would happen. In another experiment, they used the S cell extract with protease to destroy the protein. And then cultured them with the R cells. In both of these cases, there was a mixture of R cells and S cells. So the transformation occurred, just like as in the experiment of Griffith, and the cells were infectious. But in their test, where they treated the S cell extract with DNase that destroys the DNA, they cultured these S cells with R cells. They only could get R cells growing in their agar plates. So no transformation happened. And this gave them the conclusion that actually it has to be then the DNA, which is the important factor allowing this transformation of one cell type to the other. So the bacterial cells were transformed by taking up the DNA that remained in this S cell extract. So those experiments were really quite critical for showing that DNA is the genetic material. And the next kind of step that needed to be done to really understand this genetic material and its properties was also to show that it could be transformed or transmitted from one generation to the next. We said earlier that the genetic material has to have these properties, that they have an effect on the phenotype, and that they can be inherited generation after generation. And this observation that DNA is actually passed from generation to generation was proven by Hershey and Chase in their experiments in 1952, when they were using bacteriophages that would infect. So these are viruses that infect bacteria. Taking advantage of what they knew about DNA and protein, Hershey and Chase decided to radioactively label the phosphorus of DNA or radioactively label the sulfur, which is found in protein. So there's no sulfur at all in DNA, and there's only very, very, very little phosphorus in proteins. So this different labeling methods allow the researchers to distinguish DNA and protein in their different experiments. So phages that were labeled with the radioactive phosphorus were then used in an experiment to infect bacteria. And the researchers further went to remove the phages that were from the outside of the cell. And so the only thing remaining would be the infected bacterial cells that would contain the radioactive labeled DNA injected by the phages. These were then grown and the phages replicated inside the infected bacterial cells. And then after they lysed the cell and re were released from the cell, the researchers could measure, could they determine any radioactive labeling. So in the same situation, with S-labeled protein, DNA is infected into the cell and the phages are removed because in this case, there's no radioactive label on the DNA. Any replicated phages inside the bacterial cells do not have any radioactive labeling. So only in this experiment where the DNA was labeled did the researchers find radioactively labeled offspring. So they could conclude that it was DNA and not the protein that is inherited from the parental phage. Again, another condition that DNA is the genetic material. One of the other milestones of history was the discovery of the structure of the DNA molecule. And this is really important because it is this structure is gives the DNA the properties of replication and transmission of genetic information from one generation to the next. So how is that happening? If you think about the structure of DNA, what Watson and Crick published in 1953 was this double helix model of a sugar phosphate backbone with bridges of nucleotides that are bound together to create the double-stranded structure. So every nucleotide has one of four bases, adenine, thymine, guanine, or cytosine. And these will bind to each other. Adenine binds to thymine, guanine binds to cytosine. And they create a very stable structure, which has the two sugar phosphate backbones that are in anti-parallel direction. So you can see the three prime end of the structure is at one end of the strand, five prime end at the other end of the strand. And this chemical structure of the sugar phosphate backbone is rigid, and the binding is only allowed when the strands are in this anti-parallel orientation. And it's actually this structure which helps us understand how we can actually pass genetic information from one organism to the next. So, in addition to the Watson and Crick, Rosalind Franklin was also very important in making this discovery because she's the one who actually made this nice X-ray diffraction image of DNA, which allowed Watson and Crick to deduce this double helix structure. So the reason why it's so important and why it's important for transmission of information from one generation to another is because of the role of the helix in replication of the DNA and in creating the copies, new copies of this DNA. So the double helix, when it can unwind, so the two strands can be separated from each other, and each one of these strands then can act as a template or a model for which new strands of DNA can be built. So the blue strand here is sort of the old parent DNA, and the red strands are the new replicated daughter DNA that's being produced based on the model of the parent DNA strand. So it's a very critical part of this, our genetic material, that we have this DNA structure allowing this conservation of information that can then be copied and passed on to a new organism, to an offspring. So these kind of historical experiments gave a or laid the path of information of or evidence that DNA is actually the genetic material. It can contain information through the nucleotide sequences. It has the ability to replicate and transmit information from one generation to the next. And then, for the rest of the lecture, I talk about how we know more about how genes work, how we can get from DNA to the phenotype. I'll take a little break now. Pause this. Okay, so now we're going to carry on a little bit and talk about how the genetic material really affects cell function and has an effect on phenotype. So remember, that's what Mendel and most of the early researchers were focusing on, was actually on the phenotype, not on DNA. So this kind of exploration of how genes affect phenotypes is pretty exciting, and it's still something that's important, importantly, an important part of research that goes on today. But this kind of first experiments to link genes or genetic material and particular function was done in the 1940s by Beadle and Tatum. And it actually was pretty critical to actually define what a gene is, and that a gene is something that is a kind of discrete unit inside the genome. And it set the stage for something that we call genetic analysis, or think of as genetic analysis. It's really working on this connection between genotype and phenotype. So it was all based on this hypothesis that there was one gene, or one kind of, there had to be one unit of genetic material that was connected to one protein or one polypeptide that was popular in the day. And they had the good fortune to do their experiments with this bread mold called Neurospora crassa, which is also used in our department by Ilka Grönholm, who'll be part of your part of our class a little bit later. This what they did in their experiment was to create what's called a mutant library. And this method of creating a mutant library is still used today in genetic analyses. So Neurospora is really interesting because it has the it's easy to grow. For the most part, it's haploid. So it has a complex life cycle where most of the time it's in a haploid phase, and only a short amount of time it's diploid and goes through sexual reproduction. But while it's haploid, it's reproducing asexually. It has the ability to produce all the amino acids that are needed by itself, and this ability to produce amino acids is what was tested by Beadle and Tatum in their experiments. So they were testing mutants of the enzyme machinery that was is required for producing the amino acids. And this is described in your textbook in more detail if you want to read more about it. So their experiments again were to test how the fungus is able to produce the amino acids and the role of different enzymes. And the idea behind the test that if there's been some kind of mutation that affects the function of the enzyme, then it's also going to result in a lack of that enzyme for the fungus, and then it won't be able to grow unless that amino acid is added to the growth medium. So they were able to combine their understanding of biochemistry and this kind of genetic inheritance of the gene and its role in producing a protein to see if they could identify is there such a thing. So what they did was to use X-rays or UV light to create mutations in Neurospora, and they could then grow the fungus in an experimental setup, a test tube or plate, using media that had different kinds of amino acid combinations. So what's really nice about the Neurospora is that when it's makes its after sexual reproduction, there are individual spores that are produced from the meiosis in a spore sac, and so the mutations get distributed to the daughter cells and after meiosis, and then they can be picked out of the spore sac and grown individually as a asexual haploid organism. So they're quite easy to maintain. So first, what was done in the experiments was just to see are there mutants in the genetic machinery that or that codes for the enzymes required to produce the amino acids. So all the spores from the treated Neurospora were then grown under experimental conditions. Either a complete medium, which has all the amino acids, or a minimal medium, which does not include amino acids. So if the spores were able to grow in this minimal medium, it meant that they had all of the genetic capability to produce the amino acids, and they were not mutant. So they were not followed up further. But if the spores were unable to grow in the minimal medium, it meant that the mutation occurred in the genes required for construction of the amino acids. So those were kept for further study. So these mutants that didn't grow on the minimal medium could then be screened with different kinds of additives to the medium to really narrow down. Is it the amino acid chemical products, or is it some other nutrient that's missing from the minimal medium that is critical for these mutant fungi? So the mutant spores could then be grown in minimal medium that had vitamins added, amino acids added, or some nucleic acid precursors added to the medium to identify what actually is the mutation affecting. Is it affecting their use of the vitamins or nucleic acids, or is it affecting their production of amino acids? So this screening allowed the researchers then to identify those specific mutants that required amino acids to grow. So again, they're able to see the phenotype. Finally, they could get some growth if amino acids were added to the medium. They could then take this a little bit further and identify which amino acid of the different amino acids was the one affected by the mutation. So those requiring amino acids were then further tested on minimal medium with individual amino acids supplemented. And in this case, this example, we see that the spores could grow when minimal medium and arginine were added to the growth medium. So the addition of these other amino acids did not affect the growth, but it was this one that was missing from the biochemical pathway. And then going even one step further to narrow down where in the biochemical pathway the mutation occurred, the researchers could not only use the arginine as an addition to the minimal medium, but also test precursors of arginine synthesis as an addition to the minimal medium to see if the mutants could also be grown in those conditions. So the researchers knew that arginine was missing. Arginine synthesis machinery was missing from these mutant molds. But what part of the biochemical pathway was affected? Was it an upstream part of the pathway or a more downstream part of the pathway? So in this case, the mutation was able to grow also in, when citrulline was added to the medium, but not on minimal medium supplemented with ornithine, another precursor to the arginine synthesis pathway. So this experiment is an example of this mutation library, mutant library. So it's a collection of different kind of mutants that have a phenotypic effect. So they have the same output on the phenotype, but the mutations could be actually in different parts of the biochemical pathway, for example. And using this screening with minimal medium and additional nutrients or amino acids or other required precursors to the different biochemical pathways, then the researchers could narrow down which part of the expression of this phenotype is affected by the mutation. So not only did the research lead to this understanding that there's a mutation that affects a phenotype, but also to the understanding that there could be multiple mutants, either in the same cell, the same individual, that affect a phenotype, and they can could deduce the location of these different mutations, or the fact that they're both of them had to be acting on the same unit or the same gene. So this is the kind of groundwork for something called complementation testing. So if there's complementation between different mutations, the result is a normal phenotype. So the mutations are on different genes. But if in a complementation test, the effect is a mutant phenotype, the researchers can deduce that the mutations are in the same gene. So what do we mean by that? And again, here's where Neurospora crassa comes in handy as a study organism, because this fungus is able to produce something called a heterokaryon, where the cells will fuse together and the nuclear material from two different individuals becomes mixed into the fused heterokaryon. And so with the mutations generated by the mutation screening library, for example, if we have one mutant Neurospora with a mutation in the orange gene here, we would have the orange gene would not function, but the purple one would. We had a second mutant where the purple gene has a mutation and is non-functional. We have a functional copy of the orange gene. And if we were to combine these two Neurospora strains together into a single heterokaryon, we would see that the functional gene, orange gene of mutant 2, would compensate for the mutation in the orange gene of mutant 1, and vice versa, the functional gene of mutant 1 would compensate for the mutated gene from mutant 2. And these two functional copies of the gene then complement each other, and the heterokaryon fungus would be able to grow on the minimal medium. So the complementation group indicates that the mutations are on different genes. In contrast, if these two mutants were combined together in a heterokaryon, both of them having a mutation in the purple gene, one on kind of the left side here, one on the right side of the purple gene here. In both cases, these would not have a functional purple gene. If they were combined together in a heterokaryon, there would be no complementation because both of the combined mutant genotypes would have a non-functional purple gene, and the heterokaryon would not be able to grow on the minimal medium. So this is the idea behind complementation testing and recognizing that mutations in the genetic material affect the phenotype, and that these mutations can exist in different parts of the gene. If they're on separate genes, they can complement each other, but if they're in the same gene, they don't complement each other. And with this kind of crossing mutation generation and crossing, researchers can then figure out how many genes are involved in producing a particular phenotype, in this case, amino acid synthesis, for example, like arginine synthesis. So this is a very general overview of the arginine synthesis pathway and what was known at the time of the Beadle and Tatum experiment, that there's different precursors and biochemical steps, some of which were not particularly known, but there was understanding of ornithine, which was then converted to citrulline, and then which was then further converted into arginine. And so the experiments of Beadle and Tatum could identify when the mutation occurred at one part of the pathway, but not another part of the pathway. So this kind of old experiment brought up several important concepts to first light that were really critical and also very important for genetic analysis and also for understanding gene and genome function. And this idea of thinking about the connections between the genes in their kind of biochemical hierarchies is also really important. Okay, so why is it important? We want to define the gene. We want to make connections between or understand how the genes work together, interact with each other, and how they have an effect on phenotype. And also, what is this connection between DNA and protein? That DNA is a the DNA sequence is the basis for the amino acid sequence. The experiments from history also give us good example of using this experimental approach to understand or to test hypotheses and to understand this genetic basis. And the use of model organisms is also quite important in some of the conclusions that were made. So this experiments and the construction of the mutant library has been used quite a lot in understanding genetics and also not only with Neurospora, but also with Drosophila, who looked at natural mutations in Drosophila, like these legs coming out of the head of the fruit fly. And developmental genetics has also been relied a lot on understanding these mutations. So we have kind of the two different approaches that are used today, this sort of forward genetics, which is exemplified by the work of Beadle and Tatum. It's like looking for mutations and how does it have an effect on phenotype. And in reverse genetics is a little bit opposite way that is now possible thanks to some of the new advances in technology for manipulating DNA. So this reverse genetics, you can actually manipulate the DNA directly and then examine the phenotype. So you'll learn a little bit more about that later. Okay. So DNA directs the functions of cells with the connection between DNA and protein, but this is sort of an indirect connection. The DNA is first transcribed into RNA, which is then translated into protein. So the DNA doesn't th synthesize the proteins directly. That this information is completely dependent upon RNA. So the DNA is transcribed either into messenger RNA, which gives the signal of the proteins, or ribosomal RNA or transfer RNA, both of which are really important for translation and converting this message from the messenger RNA into protein. So ribosomal RNA provides structure of the ribosomes, and the transfer RNA transfers the amino acids to the ribosomal machinery during translation. So the conversion of DNA to RNA is called transcription, and the conversion of RNA to protein is called translation. So transcription happens a lot like DNA replication, except that the product of the transcript is a single-stranded RNA, not a DNA. And the RNA has a different structure. So one kind of most important thing is that the base thymine of DNA is replaced by a uracil. And the backbone of the RNA is made of a ribose instead of a deoxyribose. But just like DNA replication, when DNA is transcribed, there's this opening of the double helix so that the new messenger strand can be created and the parent DNA strand is used as a template or as the model for this construction of RNA. This again, the anti-parallel structure is also important in RNA transcription because the RNA is produced in this directional fashion, so it's always working from the three prime end to add on to the new DNA strand. In translation, the messenger RNA sequence is then deciphered based on the coding sequences of codons, so replicates of three bases together is defining a codon in the messenger RNA, and anticodons of the transfer RNA match the codons, and these anticodon sequences then allow for a specific amino acid to be joined in the correct sequence to create the amino acid sequence of the protein. So the transfer RNAs join up according to the codon sequence and transfer this amino acid that is attached to them in the correct sequence. This happens in the ribosome, which is made up of two subunits of ribosomal RNA and different proteins together. The messenger RNA is moving through the ribosome in between these different subunits, and the transfer RNAs with their associated amino acid come and meet the codon of the messenger RNA to build the new protein polypeptide sequence of amino acids. You could watch this video at YouTube to see a nice animation of this. And I also remarked about this book, which is by Venki Ramakrishnan, who was one of the critical players in understanding the structure of the ribosome. And he, with his colleagues and competitors, won the Nobel Prize for their work in 2009. And this book has a nice description of all the work that they had to do to decipher this very complex structure and understand how it's functioning. So it's really quite interesting account of the research that had to be done to understand translation. All right. So just to kind of wrap this up about genes and their connection to phenotype. The genetic information is organized into genes and the experiments of Beadle and Tatum were really kind of the beginning of trying to understand this connection between genes and phenotypes. I tested the one gene, one enzyme theories, which they showed, and also many others have showed that this does hold in many cases, but it doesn't always hold. There's lots of interactions between different genes that have an effect on the phenotypic expression. And this can be called is called epistasis. And there also could be examples of when one gene has an impact on very many different features of phenotypes. And this is called pleiotropy. And actually, there's quite many examples of hereditary diseases that are defined by more than one gene. So they're also called complex traits, and their inheritance is not always well understood because of the involvement of the very many different genes. And we haven't really talked about it much yet, but we'll in future course, future lectures. Is this the environment, of course, is really important for the expression of genes. And can influence how the gene can actually have an impact on the phenotype. And of course, these days it's not only a single gene that's a focus of study, but the whole genetic information of the organism, the whole genome. And in our if we think about the whole product of this genome are the coding proteins that are defined by the genome. We can call that the proteome. All of this information has to be organized into the cell somehow, and we can learn a lot just about this organization, and that's what we're going to talk about in the next lecture. So hopefully this little bit of explanation helped to explain the lecture. It's not exactly the same as I did it, and probably nowhere nearly as interesting or good, but hopefully it helps to explain some of the slides in a little bit more detail for you. But please be sure to read the chapters 1 through 3 of the Hardell textbook, Essential Genes and Genomics, Genetics and Genomics, and don't forget to do the Moodle quiz on the first three chapters, which is part of your grade for the course. If something still is unclear, you can always get in touch with me and ask for some more explanation. All right. Thanks. Bye.